Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Sequelize It, where we tackle the triumphs and dissect the disasters of modern movie franchises. I'm KC, and I'm plotting the annihilation of the Forest Moon of Endor, and joining me today are...
I am your foxy friend Backlash, and I have a bad feeling about this.
I'm No Chris Alive, Sequelize It's Mastodon of the Monotone, and I've been having a very Diwana Wongo week.
And this week, we will round out the original trilogy by going over maybe the most divisive film of the original trilogy, that being Episode 6, Return of the Jedi. This movie is weird. If I had to describe it one way, if I was to take an example from any popular culture, I think it would be the conversation that Dante and Randall have in Clerks. I am completely with Dante. Empire is a better movie. Randall is wrong.
Yeah. not to interrupt, but like it's a better movie, and not necessarily for the reasons that Dante says. Like, those are personal, clearly.
Yeah, but it is the better movie. I guess we'll go over that more if we ever go over the Viewisk Universe movies, which I'm not sure I want to do, because I feel like that'll...
No.
Coincidentally, that will ruin my childhood.
That's really kind of stretching the rules of what this podcast operates by.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I do know exactly what you're talking about, because I actually just watched Mallrats like a week ago. It does not hold up.
No, plus, it doesn't.
I don't think anyone can call, like, Kevin Smith's output a franchise. Like, merchandise has been made of it. And I know that this is kind of backhanded. I enjoy Kevin Smith sparingly. I used to listen to some of his podcasts, but have had no desire whatsoever to see any of his movies.
But we do have a desire to watch this movie, or at least get this movie over with. Just, what were your guys' initial thoughts going into this before you watched it? You can start, Backlash.
I have memories of this as a kid, and I feel like my memories betrayed me, because I remember liking this movie a lot as a kid, and watching it now, I can't say I dislike it. It's more I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah. How did you feel about this going in, Chris?
I mean, I'd seen it a couple of times before, and I mean, I came away from it with the take that it's ultimately uneven. I don't know. It has its iconic moments, but like some scenes just drag and are perhaps like more pointless than others, and I feel as if one's preference in those scenes is based on, or rather, whether one likes the scenes that I feel drag are based on preference.
Yeah,
I'll sort of get into that.
Yeah, I think just my initial thoughts were, I couldn't get in. Like, for New Hope, I was excited to watch it. For Empire Strikes Back, I was excited to watch it. But for Return of the Jedi, I couldn't psych myself up for it. And like, in some ways, I was able to do that for the prequels, but this movie has never captured me. I don't have fond memories of it as a kid. I don't have fond memories as an adult. It's just like, it is the movie that is there. It passed me by, I think. And I was kind of amazed at the amount of stuff that I didn't remember happens in this movie. And almost all of it annoys the hell out of me.
Yeah, and actually, to add to what I was saying, like, your mention of the prequels, I was somewhat excited to see them again, because as much as I took them as overall bad movies, I had been more engaged with the discourse around them for the past decade than I have the actual content of the texts, as it were. And I mean, hey, I have my regrets, but I mean, this, yeah, I just don't really think about Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, it's that one you kind of just accept that it's there, and just kind of move on.
I think that's the best way to put it. It's just there.
It's not even that it's forgettable. Like I talked about in our Attack of the Clones review, how it's just so forgettable. And that's not Return of the Jedi. It's striking, but not really in a good way.
I mean, it's memorable because I remember scenes in this movie, but it is also, I don't know, it's kind of like a weird movie for me to wrap my head around. It's not like I had a bad time watching this movie, because I didn't, or...
Yeah.
It's just weird. I guess.
You know, the best way I can put it is watching this movie, and just so many times I'm going like, wait, what?
Yeah, for me it was like something fairly enjoyable, something exciting, and then something sort of like, oh, they're doing this? Well, they're continuing to do this. They're still doing this. Okay, whatever.
Okay. Well, with that, we're going to go and do what we do every week, which is break down the movie act by act. But first, a little background on Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Jedi. Return of the Jedi was initially written by self-described terrible screenwriter George Lucas, with Lawrence Kasdan returning from Empire Strikes Back to give the script a page one rewrite. It was directed by Richard Marquand, who directed nothing of actual note, even compared to Empire Strikes Back director Erwin Kershner. Marquand primarily cut his teeth directing shows from British television and making documentaries, and had essentially no experience directing big-budget, effects-heavy films. So this movie was actually pseudo-directed by George Lucas, after Kershner and Lucas clashed on Empire, and Kershner elected not to return to direct another movie, which may explain why all the good stuff about Empire, the character development, the cinematography, the acting, and the plotting, promptly goes directly to hell. Fun fact, Lucas originally wanted Steven Spielberg to direct Return of the Jedi, but thanks to a pointless pissing contest with the Directors Guild of America, owing to Lucas not wanting to put Kershner's name at the front of Empire, we get whatever this is instead. Return had a budget of between $33 to $43 million, and to date has a box office total of $475 million, making it the lowest grossing mainline Star Wars movie, and it holds an 82% score on Rotten Tomatoes, at least critically.
So go ahead. Not to diverge too much, but like adjusted for inflation, that $475 million, does that compare to Solo? Like, how does that compare to Solo? Do you have like numbers in that regard?
No, I don't. I just googled it and it said $475 million.
That's fine. Because like, yeah. I'm interested to see if like.
I would guess over its lifespan, because that's just the box office. I'm guessing with releases on home video and DVD and all the re-releases, it probably made far more than that. And certainly, when you take that into account, it probably outdid Solo. But I'm talking about of the Skywalker saga, so the 9 actually titled episode movies, Return seems to have made the least.
Yeah. Also, the one bit of trivia I know about this is that in the directors that George Lucas was looking for, one of them was David Lynch.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just like, think about that and think about what he did to Dune just 1 year after Return of the Jedi.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It depends on who you ask.
I assume you haven't seen David Lynch's Dune. I can't recommend you do.
Here's the thing. Like, I would say 85% of people seriously dislike Dune, and 15% think of it as a stroke of brilliance. I would probably go on record, as far as the three of us, maybe assuming things, but I'd say I'm the David Lynch fanboy of this group. And it's like, I'm not willing to defend it. I've seen it maybe twice.
At any rate, production on the movie, I mean, I guess we're talking about directors, I don't think David Lynch was a well-liked director, and I don't think Richard Marquand was either. Production could be charitably described as tense, and includes an incident where Marquand released an expletive-laden rant at Carrie Fisher that brought the actress to tears. So fuck him. Well, not fuck him because he's passed away. But yeah, that's not cool.
Well, why not?
Because
he's dead?
Yeah.
He died.
No, fuck him anyways.
Well, that seems kind of transgressive, but man, he died pretty young.
Yeah, he did. He only died a few years after this movie was complete. I think he died in the early 90s, which is not that long. Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but still, the guy's an asshole. Just because he's dead doesn't mean you don't still call him an asshole.
Jesus Christ. Anyways, in the original script, the Empire was supposed to be building not one, but two Death Stars. And Yoda, a beloved and iconic character from Empire, was completely written out of the script until Marquand pointed out it may be good to give some closure to Luke's promise that he would return to complete his training. It's also notable for introducing the Ewoks, an idea that literally everyone except George Lucas thought was a very, very bad idea. The Ewoks are based somewhat on the Viet Cong from the Vietnam War, taking down a technically superior foe, and their portrayal here is what happens when you have a white dude who doesn't really understand what happened in the Vietnam War and why American soldiers were so ill-prepared to fight it. Spoiler, the Viet Cong didn't win with pointy sticks and rocks. With all that said, folks, let's all go to the movies. We begin with Act 1. Up in space, a small ship flies from a Star Destroyer to the new and slightly less improved version of the Death Star, because much like Jim Cornette, the Emperor thinks you could just recycle plot points and the audience won't remember because it happened a couple years ago. Darth Vader arrives and a very terrified-looking commander assures Vader that the station will be fully operational. All he needs is more time and more men and maybe a few thousand more trips to the space Home Depot. Vader tells the guy that if he has a problem, it's officially above his pay grade, seeing as though the Emperor will be showing up soon, and he's somehow even less pleased with the progress than Vader is. We jump to Tatooine, where R2-D2 and C-3PO are walking through the desert once again. 3PO really isn't about that walk up to the evil guy's house and knock on the door life, but he does it anyway, and the two droids are able to bullshit their way into a meeting with former United States President Jabba the Hutt. Jabba the Hutt. R2-D2 plays a message from Luke, and Luke sells out his two droid pals in an effort to convince Jabba to let Han free. That plan works about as well as you'd expect from a jerkass like Jabba, who basically steals the droids any fucking way. With that plan out of the window, our heroes move to Plan C, seeing as though Plan A was let Chewie and Lando handle it, and that shit didn't work, and Plan B wound up with C-3PO as a translator and R2 stuck serving drinks on a floating barge. After a terrible and totally inconsistent CGI dance number where one of Jabba's slave women is fed to a rancor, a bounty hunter comes in with Chewbacca clad in irons. They do a little back and forth. Jabba asks why he should pay top dollar for the Wookiee, and the bounty hunter takes out a thermal detonator and is like, I will blow this motherfucker up, and you will know my name is Leia, first of her name, Princess of Alderaan and the Rebellion, daughter of the Fifth House, holder of the Sacred Chalice of Rix, heir to the Holy Rings of Bezazed, breaker of chains, and hater of being forced to wear scantily clad clothing on set because the quasi-director of the movie, the actual director of the movie, forgot how my character is written. Okay, she doesn't say all that, but she does threaten to blow them up, and Jabba acquiesces. Later, Leia, still in disguise, sneaks back into Jabba's throne room and manages to free Han, but they immediately get caught. Welp, Plan C is well and truly fucked, so we're on to Plan D. Luke Skywalker just decides to walk straight into the throne room and use a Jedi mind trick on Jabba's stooge to get an audience with Jabba. Luke's all, Dormammu? Jabba, I've come to bargain. Jabba doesn't care about bargaining at this point and decides that the best way to deal with this problem is not to have Boba Fett. Oh yeah, he's here too, just chilling in the background, doing exactly jack shit. Shoot Luke in the head, but to let the Rancor kill Luke and activates his trap card, sending Luke into the pit down below. A weird pig-faced alien gets eaten whole by the Rancor, but in the time since Empire, Luke has added more points to his dexterity and agility stats, and is able to solve the puzzle of this particular dungeon by making like Link and throwing a rock at a button which crushes the Rancor and makes his handlers cry. On to plan E! Luke, Han, and Chewie are all bought before Jabba, who, once again, could just order Boba Fett to just execute them all, but instead, Jabba is gonna let the Sarlacc pit decide this. As they make their way to the pit of Carcoon, Luke insists everything is going to plan. Han, like the rest of the audience, calls bullshit. We see the Sarlacc, which I'ma just assume doesn't look so goddamn stupid in the original versions. Luke gives Jabba one more chance to not die, and like most villains, Jabba doesn't listen. And but so, Luke decides now is the time to execute his brilliant plan of get a lightsaber and start swinging at shit. You might have been tricked into thinking Boba Fett might do something in these scenes, but nah, he jobs to the wall, brother! And gets unceremoniously eaten by the Sarlacc. It'll be damn near 40 years before Boba gets anything roughly approximating a cool moment ever again. Back on Jabba's barge, Princess Leia has had enough of this shit, as has Carrie Fisher, whose motivation for this scene was most definitely imagine you're strangling George Lucas to death. And they fight and they fight and they fight and they fight, and eventually the good guys are able to escape, with Han thanking Luke for saving him, and as Luke takes off to complete his training in the Dagobah system, and Han, Chewie, Lando, Leia, and the gang go to rendezvous with the rest of the rebellion. So, we had an interesting conversation when I was watching the first act of this movie, where I think this first act of the movie really drags, and you guys think that this is the best part of the movie. And I just want to know what your thinking for that is.
Well, you see, the first half part of the movie, I feel like it's pretty concise. Like, some parts do drag, but overall, it gets the job done. The second act of the movie, I think, drags. And the third act is just a mess.
Yes, the third act, indeed, editing-wise, is a mess. I don't think that the first part is my favorite, with the caveat that I kind of like the aesthetic choices of Jabba's palace. I like how I like how his henchmen are either clad in dark black, or they're just like these odd monstrosities. I like how C-3PO goes to this back room where a droid is like wired up to the upholstery and seemingly after being tortured as a bit of intimidation.
Why are they programmed to feel pain?
Yeah. In a certain kind of vein, not that George Lucas, not that David Lynch had a specificist. I mean, he did Eraserhead, which is pretty fucking distinct. But like, if George Lucas was like, I watched Eraserhead and The Elephant Man, and I think that certain aspects of this aesthetic line with like your sensibilities, I can kind of understand why he was like, maybe David Lynch.
Yeah, it's like how you said, everything about Jabba's palace is just creepy and weird and off-putting. Yeah, it's exactly what you imagine. It's exactly what you imagine where this horrendous gangster would live, just surrounded by weirdos. And stuff that could kill you in like a second.
Yeah, getting green jizz on C-3PO, and I'm not talking about the music, but
that one fucked up music video that they added to the special edition, which in the original cut, that thing is an actual puppet.
Yeah, not just that, but like maybe they thought they had to expand on what was essentially just like a late 70s exploitation like bar scene with like shitty funk done by the local musician that they hired as a sort of composer.
I mean, this might be the best act in the movie, taken as it is, but I just find that it just doesn't entrap me in the same way that A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back does.
Oh, totally.
Like, I find it weird that the movie starts with the Empire. Like, it seems to me that you could flip the entire first act and just put the scene with Darth Vader at the end, and that would be better, because I don't know why we have to know that the Emperor is coming to the Death Star before that. I don't know. It's just...
I think one thing this movie wants to assert is the fact that, like, that Darth Vader is not the be-all, end-all of evil forces, which makes it easier for audiences to accept his redemption. Because the Emperor was such, like, a small component of the last movie. He was just a hologram. Darth Vader was, for all intents and purposes, the antagonist. Whereas you want to establish as much as possible in this movie that there's someone above him and someone that he may oppose, when we get to see the extent of like, this Emperor's character.
Yeah, I it's kind of like to say, like, shit is getting real now. Like,
yeah.
Like, the true big bad is coming.
Yeah. But
I just want to say that's like a really great moment on its own. Just the second Vader says that, like, this Imperial guy, he's nervous enough with Vader just being on it. He looks like he's about to shit his pants once he says the Emperor's coming.
Yeah,
that is true.
And as far as, like, although I like the aesthetic of Jabba's palace, like, it may, like, I can understand someone being put off by it. Like, it may not be like the right atmosphere. And this is another one of those things where when you sort of get down to it, you realize that, like, Luke busting everyone out, there wasn't so much a plan and follow-through involved with that, so much as, like, oh, Luke is confident now because he's been trained quite a bit, and he's made a sacrifice, and he's managed to potentially save his friends from being sure. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, was that Does Luke really have a plan, or does he just have a series of quasi ideas that just so happen to coalesce into something that looks like a plan?
You know, I actually wanted to talk about that, because in the 90s, that's when they started coming up with the extended universe of Star Wars, which, although that is now just legends, everything that came before the Disney buyout that wasn't the main movies and the Clone Wars TV show. And there was one book. Most of the books were set after the events of Jedi, but one of them was set before Jedi, which is supposed to show what Luke and the others were doing in between Empire and Jedi. And basically it just amounts to, oh, we took down some gangster. But I feel like there is, like, more setup in there. And I know there's nothing canonical about it now anyways. But let's actually break this down. When we ended Empire, we have Lando and Chewie going off in the Millennium Falcon saying that they're going to find Han.
Right.
At the beginning of the movie, we know Lando is undercover in Jabba's palace. Leia shows up with Chewie as her quote-unquote prisoner.
Well, I will say this. R2 and C-3PO, both C-3PO specifically says that they haven't heard from Lando and Chewie. He says that as they're walking through the desert.
So yeah, how does Luke know?
So,
well, does he even? Because his plan was send the droids, and that will be how I have an in with Jabba.
But it okay, so it's like I broke down all the plans. Like, plan A is that they're going to send Lando and Chewie, and they're going to do something. And then Lando and Chewie, they don't hear from them. And so I think plan B is send in the droids, and maybe that gets Luke an audience with Jabba. And when that backfires, somehow even though they haven't heard from Chewie, which again is a point that it's a point that they established right at the beginning that they haven't heard from Chewie or Lando. And so Luke can't know that Lando is undercover unless Lando somehow makes contact with Luke. I feel like what happened is that they wrote themselves into a corner, because at the end of the last movie they said that Lando and Chewie were gonna handle it, and they didn't know how to introduce all the characters again without coming up with some sort of contrived series of plots that somehow works.
Yeah, that brings them all together. And but I'll also say, at the very least, like, Luke can assume that if Han would be anywhere, he'd be captured by Jabba. Like, he probably mentioned, like, we could extrapolate that Han has told him who he's in debt to.
Lando says as much in Empire that he's that Boba Fett is going to take Han to Jabba the Hutt. So yeah, that is information that they know.
So it's a coincidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it all leads to kind of serendipitous moment. Actually, I had one note about something else that I wrote down that I wanted to bring up, because I'm not sure about this, but when Luke arrives at Jabba's palace, he gets stopped by two of those pig guard guys. You see him raise his hand, and they both back off, but then you see one of them, and he looks like he's clutching his throat. And I have to ask, did Luke Skywalker just straight up force choke these two?
Huh.
He may have just given him a little throat irritation.
I mean, if we're talking about the Legends books, which we shouldn't, but I guess I'm gonna bring it up anyways. In those books, Luke does learn how to use things that would technically be considered the dark side of the Force. He does know how to do Force lightning, and he does know how to do a Force choke. But I don't. I think that might have just been an acting decision by the pig guard. The pig guard. I think that was just, you know, he was just shuffling back, and maybe he just put his, you know, his hands in a kind of weird position. But I don't think Luke is force choking people at this point. Because at this point, he is still very much of the idea that the Jedi are the best. He is not at all disillusioned in this movie. I think he becomes disillusioned later on, but he at this point he is very much still, we are Jedi, we are good guys. And Luke tries to do everything he can to avoid killing Jabba, which I think is a point that needs to be brought up, is that it seems to me that Luke is trying every which way he can to not have to actually be forced to kill Jabba or really kill anyone. If he could get away with mind tricking everyone, then he would. But I get the sense he knows he can't do that to Jabba, and so that's why he has to go through all this rigmarole of all these plans.
I think that's a decent reading of it, especially since like you described in your summary, he doesn't bust out the lightsaber until it seems like they're about to be obliterated by a giant sand maw.
The Sarlacc pit, it does look way better in the original versions, right? Because it doesn't have the stupid beak.
Yeah.
Why did they make the Sarlacc have a beak, and
scientists discovered that prehistoric sand teeth actually had feathers and had bird-like features. they wanted to just make it a bit more accurate.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
They're not actually lizards or
sorry, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to insult the scientific community. Okay, so that means it's totally makes sense why the Sarlacc is basically a dinosaur of some sort.
Yeah,
and Lucas just wanted to correct that issue. It makes total sense.
Yeah, exactly. You know he would. But anyway, So as far as the disputes between Marquand and Lucas, I was watching the SF Debris series, and it seemed as if Leia probably wouldn't have been the one to kill Leia if not for Lucas. Like, he was the one that wanted her to be far less submissive than Marquand.
Yeah, it's so weird because Marquand was allegedly a fan of the prior films, particularly Empire, but he also had this weird idea that Leia needed to be more feminine, which I never got the sense that she wasn't feminine in the last movie. Yeah. She was strong, she could handle her shit, but it didn't mean that she wasn't like a badass movie, you know, a badass action movie heroine who don't need no man. You know?
Yeah, like she wasn't like a James Cameron protagonist in the second movie in the series.
Yeah,
like she's an adult. She's diplomatic. She's brazen. She could stand up to like enemy authority.
Yeah, she's not just. I just felt that was a weird directorial choice, more or less. And you do see that Leia gets way de-emphasized, I think, in this movie.
Yeah, but you know, you're talking about how she's thinking, oh, I get to choke him out. She's thinking about all the money she's going to make that she's going to spend on blow. Let's be honest.
I mean, you could do two things at once. Yeah, like I said, you can do both. Like, she can be upset and also high.
Anyway.
I don't know. I guess talking about it is kind of making me appreciate the first act more, but not much.
It's like they could, like, do you think they could conceivably have cut out the Rancor scene and just moved on to the sort of floating craft?
Yeah, it wasn't necessary. I feel like that's a theme in this movie. There's a lot of scenes that just aren't necessary.
Like, they could have even had the sort of lounge with a sort of singing, like, alien thing. Perhaps not the extended or the special edition version of it, but, like, they, just to at least, like, provide a sense of atmosphere.
I mean, I thought that extended dance scene, it's so weird because it happens, and then in the middle of it, you see Jabba's slave girl just like try and get free, and then he just decides to kill her. And it's like,
I still don't understand how she thought that was going to work.
I think, judging by her expression earlier, I think she was just like, F it, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, at least I should try, and then if I die, I die. I'm imagining being Jabba's slave girl probably isn't pleasant to a large fucking degree. Considering how reprehensible and gross Jabba is, I'd imagine he does not treat his concubines well. I don't know. It's not that I, like I said, talking about it helps, but I just feel like This beginning doesn't grip me. And I think it's because there's just too much happening, right? Like, there needed to be one, maybe two plans. You know, there's easy way you can rearrange it so that, why does Luke have to send the droids first? Like, this movie could have easily opened with that scene of Luke, like, calmly and coolly strolling into Jabba's palace, and what would be different about it?
Well, I feel as if there are certain odd parallels to A New Hope. Starting out, like, from the we start out with the Star Destroyer, like, the low angle on that. We start, like, our first protagonist characters are C-3PO and R2-D2. Sort of getting into something again.
They're back on Tatooine.
Yeah. I guess to bring things full circle, but that's possibly the reason why.
Again, it's like poetry. It's that they rhyme.
It's weird, right? Because part of the issue that Lucas was having was that Kirshner didn't do the movie according to his vision. And there are little things he does in this movie which are not exactly a jab, but meant to sort of assure the audience, no, you know, I know that last one was dark, but hey, it's still the same old fun Star Wars that you love. And it's like, okay, but like, Empire expanded so much on the world of Star Wars and what people thought the franchise could be. It seems kind of regressive to go back to this more almost immature. Again, we talked about how Lucas directed American Graffiti, and this at times definitely has that teen comedy feel, especially this first act. It feels like this scene could be like, with a few rewrites, could be like an American Pie. And I'd be like, yep, it checks out. You know, the gang and Stifler, for some reason, Stifler's held up somewhere and they have to bring Stifler. And we're going to do the American Pie franchise too at some point. I just haven't decided when I want to ruin our lives.
I'm okay with that. There's some franchises I'm really going to oppose, and one I'm going to outright refuse, but I'm okay with American Pie.
If we ever get a Patreon, I'm making you do that. You realize that, right?
No, there's one I absolutely refuse to do, and I'll tell you which one it is off outside of recording.
Okay.
It's not the one you think it is.
Okay.
It's not the franchise that at the time of this recording recently had like a release for some reason.
No, it's not that one.
Okay. So we are going to have to do that shit.
I've accepted that one as an inevitability.
Anything else that stands out about I feel like we're not really talking about what happens, but I feel like that's mostly because everything happens and nothing happens. It's prequel disease before the prequels. Everything happens and nothing happens.
The only difference is that it's practical effects and thus like perhaps a bit more appealing in execution.
Yeah. So with that, I think that we can move on to Act 2.
All right. Act 2. We hear the Imperial March theme for the third time. The total occurrences of this leitmotif still don't quite compare to Empire Strikes Back, but who's counting? As we see Emperor Palpatine for the first time in the pale, wrinkled, and commanding flesh. Speaking of olds, Luke has returned to Dagobah to seek more wisdom and training from Yoda, who is nevertheless on his last legs. After having his worst fears about his parentage validated, Luke watches another mentor leave behind nothing but their clothes. Yoda assures Luke that his training will soon be complete, and then the old master becomes one with the Force. Young Skywalker then confers with the spectral form of Obi-Wan. The clever old bastard dances around his caginess in the first movie to further confirm that Vader is Luke's father. He then tells Luke that he took it upon himself to train young Anakin, more lies, and that Luke has another Force-sensitive member of his family in Leia. Notwithstanding the virtue of Guinness getting more money and perhaps a better send-off than last time, Obi-Wan also lets Luke know that he must face and defeat Vader, despite the kid's misgivings. The Rebel Force, from our heroes to the droids to Mons, both Mothma and Calamari, convene over their next plan of attack. The Empire's unfinished Death Star may or may not be operational, but in order to ensure that it won't cause any further death and destruction, must be destroyed. The plan is for Lando to pilot the Falcon and lead a fleet to destroy the station from the inside out. However, another group must destroy its shield generator housed in a base on the forest moon of Endor. This is where Han, Luke, Leia, and some other rebels come in. Our trio of heroes infiltrate the moon via stolen Empire craft and clever subterfuge. On Endor, Han and Luke's attempt at stealth alerts stormtroopers who speed away on bikes to warn their allies of this intrusion. The two are in hot pursuit, leaving Leia behind to be confronted by a feisty and suspicious teddy bear. Her quick-witted diplomacy works on this little fella. Luke and Han do everything they can to ensure that the soldiers are not able to alert their superiors of the rebel presence, despite Palpatine's brilliant, wrinkled-ass knowing. in an exciting chase with explosions and Evil Dead style zooming. After the action, the men are worried about Leia before being confronted by a cavalcade of more teddy bear creatures. If one pays attention to Harrison Ford, they could see him taking the Ewoks seriously for precisely 0 seconds. Unfortunately, the stuffed animals are going to burn and eat them. Fortunately, C-3PO can speak their language, whereupon he is revered as a god. Luke uses the Force to engender some comedy and save their lives. C-3PO does a dog and pony show to bring the Ewoks up to speed with Episode 4 and 5. With the Ewoks finally on the Rebels' side, Luke reveals to Leia that they're siblings. She does not, however, smarten Han up to this. Next morning, before the effort to reach the Death Star's shield generator, Luke willingly capitulates to his father. Yeah. A lot of shit I cut down. But
yeah, that is perhaps the most concise description of Act 2 that can be said.
Speaking of prequel syndrome, like, yeah, that's probably the reason why I didn't describe like Ewoks in the speeder chase in great detail, because it was at that point that I was like, they have a plan, but they don't have like any sort of actual ways conceivable ways that they're going to execute it. It was like the Jedha scene in Rogue One, where it's like they get to where they need to go, but you don't feel like they got there from their own efforts.
I think the only thing you can do is compare this movie to Empire. And a lot of... I mean, part of what Lucas didn't like about Empire was that they didn't have loads of different shots that he could piece together in editing, and that Kirshner was more or less, he was surgical with what he chose to include in the movie and what he chose not to. Here is where you see that coming into play, because is the speeder chase in a vacuum, is it exciting? Yes. Is it exciting the first time you see it? Yes. Is it exciting upon rewatching it? I don't know that it is.
Here, on the subject of the speeder chase, it is exciting. Like, there's something viscerally fun about it. But I would say, with a lot of irony, it's almost like the anti-pod race, where they're beyond stopping the stormtroopers from alerting other Empire forces. Like, you don't get a sense that, like, this extended bracing scene is there for any kind of reason, whereas the pod race is like the culmination of a few problems that have been set up from that point on.
Right. This chase feels like it's happening for no reason. Yes, they have to stop the stormtroopers, but it still doesn't feel like it is at all. You could cut because I don't think it's that it doesn't last that long as a sequence, but I feel like you could cut 2 or 3 minutes out of it and nothing about it would change, and it might make the pacing feel a little bit tighter, less drawn out. Again, upon a rewatch, because I do remember liking the scene a lot when I first saw it, but looking at it now, I'm just like, this is just, it's going on too long, and the longer it goes on, the more I feel like the effect itself is starting to like bother me. And in talking about the pod race, you know, I think I mentioned that the pod race had a lot more. I like the pod race because you could tell where everything is, you could see where the geography of everything is, where the danger is, and everything. Here they're just flying through trees and you don't know where they're going, and stuff explodes, and it's not like you can't see everything that's happening, because we haven't reached the point of shaky cam shenanigans yet, but it does feel a bit like, okay, I feel like we should be moving on to the next part.
Yeah,
now
thinking back to the whole scene where Rebels convene, like, we have Mon Mothma, we have Ackbar. They discuss what the basic plan is, but they don't, for instance, they don't say we're going to take the Imperial craft that we got, use the codes, and then land in this specific spot that would be tactically necessary, that would be far away enough, but close enough that we know where we're going to get to this, where the shield generator is housed.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like they as soon as they landed, it didn't really seem like they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, it didn't seem like they actually had a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if we're going back to Rogue One, they formulate a plan. It's a little haphazard, but they have a general idea of what the goal is and what they need to accomplish and what they need to do.
Yeah, by the end of it, yeah.
Here, it feels a lot more like we're just going to do this thing. And by the way, the only reason that this succeeds is because Darth Vader knows that Luke is on the transport. If not, then they would have been destroyed in that plan over. Game over. Like,
I mean, if that's the case, why didn't he just, like, bring Luke to the Emperor, seeing as the Emperor was already there?
I don't know.
I do want to comment on one thing, and that's the way Vader and the Emperor interact with each other. Because rewatching this, I kind of noticed, and with knowing the context of the prequels, I was actually noticing that it's treated a lot more like an abusive relationship. Like, just very subtly. Like, like, you could tell that Vader is straight up simping around the Emperor.
Yeah, kind of. It's, and I don't know if that's on purpose or if that's context that we're putting on it after the fact. In the cold, harsh light of knowing, like, how abusive relationships work now compared to how what we did in the early 80s or what have you, but it very much, it is in manipulative relationship where the Emperor is just, he is very clearly just toying with Vader because he doesn't need Vader anymore. He really doesn't. He senses that there is someone who could be way more powerful than Vader, and he wants that guy. And Vader at that point is just a means to an end to the Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, Vader has always just been a means to an end for the Emperor. He's always going to go for the most powerful ally he can, and as soon as that ally is replaced by someone who is way stronger, he has no need for the last guy. It happens with Dooku, and to some extent it happens with, well, no, because Grievous was more Dooku's kind of apprentice. But it does happen with Dooku, and we're seeing it happen again with Vader. And we will see it happen unbelievably again in the sequel trilogy. Oh, boy. Every day we step closer to those movies, and I am excited and terrified.
Just remember, at least we ease into it with The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
But well, is it time to talk about teddy bears now?
No.
God damn it. No, let's wait.
I mean, not that I'm trying to avoid it, but, like, also, I want to propose the idea that as much better as Alec Guinness is in this movie, and as much as it's still, like, the sort of original trilogy Yoda, like, with the same cadences and the same, like, shakiness, that fucking scene was pointless.
Well, it was added. It was clearly added after the fact because Yoda wasn't in the script at all for Jedi before. This is the one addition that Mark Kwan, like, added to the movie because he was like, it's not going to make sense if Yoda is the one to complete Luke's training, but Yoda just doesn't show up at all, but Obi-Wan shows up. The fact that neither I don't know if Kasdan brought that up with Lucas or not, but that scene feels pointless because it was never intended to be there in the first place.
Yeah, it really, again, it's just validating, like, although The Empire Strikes Back hangs on Luke somewhat being begrudging toward his old mentor, it's still, like, all it does is say, yes, Luke, he's your father. Yoda says that.
Yeah.
Dies. Obi-Wan says, yes, Luke, he's your father. The one thing aside from structure, like, the one thing that amused me though was when Obi-Wan says, like, the last thing you need to do is confront your father, and Luke says, like, I can't fight him, and you see this, like, this motherfucker face that.
No, I feel like the point of that scene was they're trying to walk back because, you know, Obi-Wan pretty much was being very cagey about it in the first movie, like, not pretty much because they hadn't decided on that twist yet, but they have to kind of walk back that explanation. That's why they added this in. But I was wondering, because Alec Guinness didn't want to be in this, and you can tell he didn't want to be in this by the scene, because, like, skipping ahead to the end of the movie, where they replace, what's his name, David Prowse, with Hayden Christensen, why didn't they just refilm the scene with Ewan McGregor for the special edition?
Because everyone likes Obi-Wan. I don't know.
See, because if they did, especially if they did it for both of them, it actually would have made a little bit more sense.
I think George Lucas was doing that to I guess, like, respect Alec Guinness's memory, despite the fact that he may not. Was Sebastian Shaw alive at the time of the special editions? That'll be something to look up real quick.
Yeah, it wasn't David Prowse is the guy in the costume. It's Sebastian Shaw is who plays. Sebastian Shaw.
Why did I think that was David Prowse? It doesn't look anything like him.
First thing that comes up, of course, is a comic villain actor.
He died in 94.
Yeah, so he wouldn't have been around to brief.
So George Lucas pisses on one person's memory, but not on another's.
Yeah.
I can think of for that, for like that not being Ewan McGregor.
Yeah. He just doesn't. And like this whole Dagobah scene just seems not to have a. Like the whole point of Luke going back is to finish his training. And they basically say, hey, we're not going to finish your training, but you'll finish your own training when you. Gil Vader, that's when your training will be complete. And I don't know. Again, we're running into these are issues that we were talking about in the prequels, and they're present here. Again, you could trim down these scenes, and what functionally about the movie changes? Like, what happens if. Let's just say that Luke decides not to go back to Dagobah. Like, what is different about the movie? Like, he already know, like, he could go and rendezvous with the rebels, and then Obi-Wan could show up and say, you know, unfortunately, Yoda has passed. Oh, by the way, yes, Vader is your father. And you see, from a certain point of view, I was telling the truth, blah, blah, blah. Like, nothing about that scene, it doesn't add anything to the movie except time. It's the exact same problem as having Han have a conversation with Greedo and then making Han have that exact same conversation with Jabba. It's the Department of Redundancy department. It doesn't need to be there.
And also, like, again, so many pointless scenes in the prequels. There is many pointless scenes in this, and I'll just repeat myself that, like, the difference is, like, I'm happy to see Alec Guinness and Frank Oz in the puppet.
Yeah. Okay, so do we, I guess we can talk about the fucking Ewoks now.
First off, Chris, I want to say I'm so glad you called them teddy bears, because that's exactly the same thing I wrote down.
Good. I mean, that's what they are. They're
just, yeah!
They're teddy bears with spears and with teeth necklaces.
While I was watching this movie, I think I chatted to everybody. I'm like, this scene is still fucking going on. Like, it just wouldn't end with this Ewok shit. And I'm like trying to put, like, the cynical mind to sleep and just be like, okay, it's just a movie. These teddy bears don't fucking matter. It's fine. You just get through it. But it just keeps going and going and going. And it doesn't end. And we spend so much time with the Ewoks. Like, I pointed this out to you guys. Remember, Luke was supposed to have a sister in this movie. And Lucas decided that it would have been dumb to spend so much time introducing a brand new character. Yet, he spends an insane amount of screen time on introducing these fucking stupid woodland creatures that I just want to see get stomped by a transformer or something.
And speaking of things being dragged out, it's like C-3PO, like, sort of earning their trust or sort of like keeping up the charade of the whole thing.
He basically retells the entire plot of the first two movies in their language with sound effects.
Yeah, with sound effects, which is,
we didn't need that.
That's the kind of like comedy that's just like arbitrary and non-situational, similar in a sense to sort of Luke finally intimidating or convincing them that C-3PO is a god by floating the chair that he's on.
Yeah, it does. I mean, but that makes no sense because they already think he's a god.
It's unwelcome comic relief. Like, it's not comic relief that's a result of the characters, like the droids.
Yeah. Does R2 kind of get screwed in this movie because he doesn't really do anything? Like,
aside from having Luke's lightsaber at the beginning, and one thing that happens later that I'll talk about, yeah, he doesn't really do much.
This scene went on forever, and nothing, very little that is relevant to the actual plot that the rebels should be. Nothing about their mission is accomplished in this 20-30 minutes of screen time. We're with the Ewoks. Nothing happens. Like, what? Very little of the story is advanced until almost the end of the act, basically. And we spend all that time learning about characters that no one gives a shit about. And if you wanted to be cynical, you could totally say that this was an example of George Lucas clearly thinking more about toys and franchises and future cartoons than he was thinking about what actually served the fucking movie. None of these characters serve the movie at all. And the Ewoks deserve basically every bit of shit that they get, because even more so than Jar Jar, because at least in his own stupid fucking way, Jar Jar had moments where he was kind of, sort of involved in almost making the plot of the movie go forward. They were
just sort of a way out when really George Lucas could have had a bunch of rebels landing on Endor and then there being a ground skirmish and being creative with like how that was thought and like how the rebel side took it. Like, it would have been, like, kind of rote, but they could have been creative with it at the same time. Mm.
You know, if nothing else, this did start the tradition of Warwick Davis appearing in Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
I mean,
And just to think, it took all the way until Solo for him to get a spoken line of dialogue.
I mean, do we want to believe that Willow actually transformed into an Ewok, and that this is just yet another extended cut of Shadow Moon where Willow becomes Thorn Drumheller, and maybe this is just him in hiding. I keep bringing up those books because I want other people to read them. But Yeah, that aside had about as much point to it as the fucking Ewoks did. Moving on, how did you guys feel about this is I feel like a point that this Luke and Leia, let me start over. So the part where Luke reveals that he is Leia's brother and that Vader is their father, did anyone else think the dialogue in that scene didn't sound like it belonged here? Because in A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, they speak very casually. They speak basically just like normal human beings. And here, I don't know, there was like some weirdly almost Shakespearean kind of prose here where they're talking to each other, but they don't sound like they're actually human.
That overly affected George Lucas dialogue that would later pop up again with Padme and Anakin, where again, instead of talking shop, like it has to be something like fateful and destined and something bigger than the characters. I mean, my issue, I didn't quite notice that, like, not that the dialogue isn't hackneyed. My whole issue is just like Leia not outright telling Han what's going on. Like, is there any, there doesn't appear to be any reason for her to keep the information of her familial relations from him. Because all that did really was make him feel like conflicted and have self-doubt.
It's like it's keeping part of that love triangle thing going after it's been revealed that there's no love triangle, because there can't be now. It's just keeping the thought of that alive for, again, no purpose, because when Leia reveals to Han that Luke is her brother, it's like he doesn't even have like a big reaction to it. He's just like, oh, so that means I don't have to worry about Luke. Okay. It's just it keeps an unnecessary level of tension that's not even really tense. It's just there.
I don't know. Is it a double standard that I'm not bothered by the dialogue? I don't know. It just never bugged me. Maybe I'm used to it. Maybe I'm numb. I don't know. The only line that bugs me is once Luke tells Leia that he's her brother, she says, "Somehow I always knew." meanwhile, cut back to that scene from Empire. You know the one.
Of course. Basically, like a sort of jealousy move, but yeah, it's Lucas. That's I can't get mad at the characters. Their god is entirely fickle and inconsistent.
I mean, I said back in Empire that I don't really care that Luke and Leia kiss in that movie, because it doesn't matter because Lucas didn't know at the time. But now I feel like going back and revisiting that, because at this point Lucas does know and he added that fucking line in, and so now it does make it a weird incesty thing, and it didn't have to be. Like, it's just baffling, this whole sequence.
They never had a plan for a trilogy. They never had a plan for a trilogy. Oddly enough, a theme that'll come up in our next trilogy.
You think they would learn their lesson? Apparently not. So, does anyone else have any other comments on Act 2?
Nope.
No.
All right, then. We go to the thrilling conclusion of the original trilogy, on to Act 3.
Luke surrenders himself in the hope that Vader can be turned, but Vader only responds with, "Bitch, you know how many kids I killed? Ain't no going back from that." Meanwhile, the teddy bear army has assured the rebels they can get them into the shield generator. While one teddy bear tries to learn how to ride a speeder bike, the rest of the group sneaks into the shield generator.
Aboard the Death Star, Luke is brought before the Emperor, who goes into full troll mode, gleefully explaining that everything has been a setup and the Rebels are walking into a trap. The Rebel toy commercial fleet arrives at the Death Star, thinking the shield is down, but Lando's co-pilot, Weird Skin Flap Man, is able to tell they're being jammed because... Shut up. The attack is broken off. It's a meme! I mean, it's a trap! Back in the throne room, the Emperor continues to troll Luke, trying to goad him into attacking, but Luke is having none of it. Back in the Forest Moon, gee, we're jumping around a lot, things look dire as our heroes are at the mercy of Imperial troops. But their luck changes as teddy bears come to the rescue, easily overpowering the heavily armed Imperials with primitive weapons such as rocks and sticks. Am I really watching this? Is this real life? Han and Leia are unable to re-enter the shield generator, so it's up to R2 to save the day. Sick of scene jumping? Too bad, as we go back to the space where the fleet is trying to hold out against the Death Star, but things look grim as it is revealed the Death Star is now operational and a fleet of Star Destroyers block their escape. Back on Endor, stormtroopers continue to fall before the dreaded pointy sticks. R2 attempts to open the shield generator doors, but takes a stray shot and is disabled, leaving Han to improvise. Back to space! The Rebel fleet is taking a beating, deciding to directly engage the Star Destroyers. The Emperor continues to troll Luke at how badly his friends are getting their asses kicked. Luke finally has reached his limit and grabs his lightsaber and crosses swords with Vader. Teddy bear update! The Imperials' last advantage, their walking mechs, is quickly turned against them as Chewbacca commandeers one, sending them into full retreat. Meanwhile, Han is completely screwed up breaking through the door, and Leia is shot. At the mercy of a callback to Empire, they manage to escape the last of the stormtroopers. Back aboard the Death Star, Luke and Vader continue their duel, but Luke quickly realizes that fighting is dumb and instead tries to reason with him. Memories of sand flood Vader's mind, only fueling his anger as he lashes out at Luke, sending him fleeing. Back on Endor, the Rebels trick the Imperials into exiting the base, only to be caught off guard by pointy sticks, finally giving them the opening to blow the shield generator. And before we can even process that, we go back to the throne room as Vader hunts Luke, teasing him that if he can't turn Luke, he'll turn Leia. Luke goes into full rage mode, wailing on Vader until yet another hand is cut off. The Emperor is pleased with Luke's anger, but Luke remembers the advice that was everywhere in the 80s. Just say no. Next scene! The shield generator is finally down, giving the Rebels the opening they need to attack. Next scene! The Emperor has had enough and decides he'll just kill Luke with force lightning. I thought it was supposed to give you a monster face, but whatever. Luke pleads to his father for help, and Vader finds he's not really getting much out of this relationship with the Emperor. With his signature cry of, "No!" he picks up the Emperor and throws him up the catwalk where he falls into some sort of reactor, who the fuck built this place, and explodes. I'm sure he's fine, though. Next scene! Back in space, the Rebels begin their assault on the Death Star as the fleet focuses on the Executor. With their shields knocked out, one pilot who skipped lessons on how to break in space crashes right into the bridge, sending the Executor crashing into the Death Star. Next scene! Chaos has erupted on board the Death Star as Luke tries to escape with his father, but Vader has really just had enough of this crap and just wants to die. Luke takes his mask off as Anakin Skywalker says his final words to his son before passing away. A truly emotional scene. But enough of that, let's blow this bitch! The Rebels strike the final blow at the power generator of the Death Star, sending it and the Empire up in flames. Never mind that there's still plenty of Imperials out there. The galaxy is in celebration! Everything is fine, and Cerberus is over finally forever, the end.
I gotta say, first of all, bravo. Second of all, like, you really captured the way that the climax, like, plays tug of war with your attention.
You know, as bad as this is, I just want to remind people that Phantom Menace is worse. And if we'd been doing this format back then in episode one, it would have been even worse.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But is it, I mean, is it worse, though? I mean,
yes, it is.
No, it is worse.
Okay.
I enjoy the Luke and Vader confrontation. All of it is good. I enjoy Palpatine, like, getting more and more sort of aroused.
Palpatine is just great in this. Like, when I said he's trolling him, I literally mean that.
Yeah, Ian McDermott's having so much fun just being like a completely reprehend. He's like, if I'm going to play the most evil motherfucker in the world, I'm going to give him zero redeeming qualities. Just none. None at all. You're going to want to see this guy die. But But yeah, just the pacing of this last act. Again, it's prequel syndrome. I think we have a name for it now. If it ever happens in any other movies, it's so much stuff is happening and you bounce back and forth between scenes. None of the scenes are really, they drive the plot forward, but they don't drive the story forward. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. Yeah. There's a distinction between plot and story. But I mean, and the funny thing is, like, in contrast to what I was complaining about, like, down on Endor, like, those first scenes, is that, like, everyone at the very least knows what they're doing, but you're still, like, emotionally, like, going from, like, one kind of tone to another, and it just doesn't work out. Like, and also, you making reference to Vader killing children, like, it'll just never get out of anyone's head. When Anakin says, "You were right about me," I wrote in my notes, "Also, Luke, I killed a bunch of children and some Tusken Raiders, but like a lot of children and a lot of Raiders."
Like, I mean, I do like Luke and Vader's relationship a lot. I do think those scenes are well acted. It's the one place where the kind of hackneyed dialogue sort of kind of works. I don't know. And maybe that's just down to James Earl Jones's stellar voice acting that you know, I feel like you can hear in his voice, like, the remorse, the trepidation, you know, the disbelief that he is still that Anakin Skywalker. You can hear Anakin kind of wants to believe he is still a good person. Unfortunately, Anakin also knows on some level what he's done and how he can't be a good person. So his only choice is to bring his son over to the dark side of the Force. And maybe, again, I said it in Empire, that it seems to me like Anakin's plan at this point is to turn Luke and then take down the Emperor, and then they can rule together. And the Emperor's plan is to turn Luke and then take out Vader, and then they can rule together. Yeah, I think of the many, many scenes that happen in this climax, these are the scenes that, one, I wish happened with less interruptions, and two, that I feel are probably the most well done.
Yeah, but that's not the entire movie, is it?
No, it's not, and it's we do, R2 jobbed to a door. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, he did.
I mean, he just, R2 just has nothing to do in this movie, which is weird, because, like, I feel like he is such a character in A New Hope, and he's definitely, he's not as much of a character in Empire Strikes Back, but kind of like this, I don't know, this, like, pet owner relationship that Luke has while Luke is training on Dagobah and R2 is just, like, beeping and whistling along. I like R2-D2. I'm not afraid to say that. R2 is cool, and it seems kind of weird that in the last movie, he just doesn't do anything at all. Like, the one thing he should be able to do, he fails at. Is there just not much to say about this act, because it's all...
No, I mean...
Well, again, we could keep asserting, like, you have Han, Leia, and Chewie being sort of relieved after sort of their battle to a hard cut to the lightsaber. You have the Anakin and Luke's final moments to sort of, like, the Death Star destroying. It's
just Anakin.
not a good juxtaposition.
And again, the lightsaber battle is great. I like a lightsaber battle that has stakes and that moves the story forward and tells us something about where the characters are and where the characters are going. And I guess this is... I keep going back and forth on whether I should do my rant now or if I should save it to the Last Jedi. I think Luke... I was reading an article somewhere. I think it was on AV Club, where the person basically wrote what they were finding amongst fans who were pissed off with Luke's characterization in The Last Jedi was that they have a very different interpretation of why Luke spares Darth Vader. So in the minds of those fans, the reason that Luke spares Vader is because Luke is the most powerful Jedi, and he realizes he's the most powerful Jedi, and therefore he's going to spare Vader because, not because he's his father, not because he wants to redeem him, but because he is the most powerful, most badass, most wise Jedi that there ever is and that there ever will be. If we talk about like the extended universe of Star Wars and those novels, and a lot of those novels sort of continue that deification of Luke as like, as basically the second coming of Space Jesus. He is immaculate, aside from the times he turns to the dark side. But mostly he's immaculate, and Luke never does anything wrong, and he is always on the side of good, and he is perfect. And to see Luke not be perfect in The Last Jedi is what pisses fans off. I think that is not what is happening here. I think what's happening is that Luke does let his anger finally get the best of him, and he cuts off Vader's hand, and I think he has a moment where he realizes that if he keeps going, the cycle is just going to continue. If he strikes down Vader, he will just join the Emperor, and the cycle is just going to continue. He's smart enough to know and to recognize that.
Well, yeah, he's able to exhibit mercy. And I don't understand how, like, as a fan, you could fail to identify that. Like, the difference between you and me is that, like, I'll let you live rather than completely destroying you at the whim of a master or whatever.
Yeah. This version of Luke, I think, is completely in character with the Luke that we meet in the sequel trilogy. And I think the reason why... I'll just say it. I think the reason why Luke loses so much faith in the Jedi is because he has this moment here, which I think is the moment where he truly brings balance to the Force, because I think this is the moment when he decides that the thing that's throwing the Force out of balance, at least in my own headcanon, is that the Jedi and the Sith are always at each other. And the Jedi, despite being, you know, supposed to be galactic peacekeepers, but they don't try to redeem the Sith. If a Sith is out there, they just try to kill it, because that's what you do, because the Sith are bad guys, period. And I think this version of Luke is like, this cycle has to stop. If I do this, I'm just going to become this. This is probably... He doesn't know what happened to Vader at this point. I think he has a sense that the cycle is just going to keep continuing, and he decides to end the cycle. And I think that is a far more interesting and complex version of Luke than the version of Luke who just, like, wants to wreck just wants, decides not to kill Vader because he just is a badass and is like, I don't have to kill him.
You know, it's worth noting something I actually noticed for the first time watching this. Luke goes to the Emperor expecting not to survive this. Like, he says to the Emperor, pretty soon I'll be dead and you along with me, because as far as he knows, the Rebel fleet is coming to blow the Death Star up.
That is true.
Not if J.J. Abrams has anything to say about it.
God damn it.
The sequel trilogy is going to be fun. But yeah, I think that's kind of my... The only takeaways I have for this, because no real character stuff happens with anyone except Luke, that's my kind of takeaway from it, is that is in the larger franchise of, I can understand why Luke ends up in the place where he ends up in The Last Jedi, based on what he does here. And I guess I will save that rant, which I feel like I'm going to have to write down and read off to make it sound, one, coherent, and two, for it not to just last like an hour, because I could go for an hour. I did that with my coworker once. We spent all day at work complaining about The Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker. And we were nerds, and the customers were confused.
There's really nothing of consequence to say about anything else, because everything else is, as I called it, just one big toy commercial.
Yeah, here's the X-Wing, here's the Y-Wing, here's the Rebel Fleet, here's the Executor, here's the incomplete Death Star, here's the Ewoks, who will be in their own cartoon series, which is apparently officially coming to Disney Plus. No, we will not watch it. I refuse.
No, we're looking at film series, not television series.
I guess with that, what I wanted to get into more was, what do we all think of George Lucas's? Because we've seen all six of the movies that... Well, we've seen five movies he... how do I want to put this? We've seen four movies he definitely directed. We've seen one movie that he didn't direct. And we saw one movie that he pseudo-directed. But these are all undoubtedly... still, for the most part, George Lucas's vision. Still his ideas. And so I wanted to know, before we move on to George Lucas having functionally no involvement whatsoever in Star Wars, what your opinions of George Lucas are, if your opinions have changed, if they've been validated, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I've said it in a previous episode, but I'll say it again. George Lucas is a creative. He's an idea man. But he needs someone to refine his ideas. Because, like, if you read the first draft of what would eventually become episode 4, it's pretty much just unrestrained. That's a good way to describe it. Like, there's so many ideas, there's so many characters. In the words of Rick McCollum, it's so dense. There's so much happening at once. And it's just not realistic to put into a movie. That's why the prequels don't work. That's why Star Wars needed to be saved in editing. That's why this movie is such a mess. Because when you just let him do what he wants, it's just, you can't keep up with all of it. It's sensory overload. It's script overload. And when there's so much going on in a movie, it's hard to care about anything. That what few good points have a harder time sticking out in between all the just noise.
Uh, I am more or less on track with that. I can appreciate certain things that he established that ultimately, like, people were able to sort of expand or able to iterate in ways that are very appealing. It's clear, like, for the very first film, like, he was very passionate, very hardworking. He had a lot of ideas. And the fact of the matter is, like, he didn't have to, like, rely on people to sort of, like, make the dialogue in the script, the first movie, less esoteric or insist to effects supervisors and the special effects crew that things need to look as naturalistic as possible. Like, these are things that are wholly unrealistic, but he needed them to look naturalistic. Ultimately, like, the spark that he made or that he sort of, like, conducted ended up with something pretty special, something fairly entertaining. But I think the insistence of himself, whether there are certain aspects of his passion that he didn't realize, certain aspects, stories that he wanted to tell, or he convinced himself that he wanted to tell, he went a little overboard with it. He ultimately, like, even after, like, Return of the Jedi was a fairly necessary movie to make with the way Empire Strikes Back ended. The prequel trilogy, though, like, I don't think anyone had any need for that. Like, there didn't need to be a sequel trilogy, whether by him or by anyone else, but, like, the franchise had become, like, bigger than its origins, bigger, even as complex as it was from the first script, like, it became too big. So I would say, yeah, it was overall validated, and I have more or less the same opinion, even though, like, and this is as a direct result of the aforementioned SF Debris series, like, I at least kind of have, like, a bit more understanding of, like, his intent or how that intent may have changed or how it may have been changed by circumstances outside of his control. But I feel more or less the same way.
Yeah. I wrote something down in an attempt to be somewhat brief. I don't know if it's going to be, but just here it goes. George Lucas, as an artist, is undoubtedly one of the most creative and influential filmmakers of all time. His ideas for what would sell to an audience, separate from merchandising or anything like that. I don't mean sales in that way. I mean selling and bringing an idea to life in a way that an audience would completely buy into. Gave birth to a franchise that is hugely important in my life and formulates a lot of my earliest and most fond childhood memories. George Lucas, the executive, and George Lucas, the director, often get in the way of Lucas as a creative. New Hope and Empire Strikes Back stand as triumphs of what can happen when Lucas stands firm in his vision, but also allows for collaboration and, to be honest, to tell him when his ideas suck. Return of the Jedi stands as a movie where Lucas became so terrified that one of the most successful franchises of all time would fail that he slowly but surely lost the collaborative spirit, which explains why, in my opinion, Jedi isn't really a good film. By the time the prequels rolled around, Lucas had put a tremendous amount of pressure on himself, and though he knew that he wasn't a great writer or a great director, His fear of failure caused him to become even more possessive of the material. The prequels are also examples of how unfettered creativity and the ability to create almost anything in a computer can damage the spirit of a franchise that, while always more fantasy than science fiction, felt more real and lived in than the world of the prequels. That said, Lucas's reputation as an out-of-touch supervillain who makes movies to, and I hate this phrase, with the fiery passion of 1,000 red-hot suns, rape their childhoods, is completely and utterly out of line, nearly unforgivable. The movies that you loved as a kid are still there, as Backlash and Chris have shown by getting their completely legal despecialized editions. If Jar Jar Binks and angsty teen Anakin really ruined your childhood, maybe your childhood just sucked and the movies are just okay. Lucas is neither a hero or a villain. He's just a rich, creative dude with some good ideas and some bad. So, in his own way, before he sold the franchise to the Empire itself, Lucas brought balance to the Force and to his own little universe. And on that bombshell, I guess we're finally doing it. We're finally going to be talking about basically the reason why I kind of wanted to start this podcast, so I could talk about these movies with people who I believe have firm ideas of what makes a good movie and what doesn't make a good movie, and also people that I think will challenge those ideas. Does anyone remember how they felt when they learned that Lucas wasn't going to have any involvement in the franchise anymore and that it was going to get sold to Disney?
As someone who, again, for the most part, my interaction with like him as a figure was Red Letter Media, I was like, ooh. I thought, oh, this might be nice. But,
I don't know. Like, maybe we'll talk more about this on when we get to the prequel movies, but I feel like it's definitely a shitty thing that they told him, oh yeah, we'll let you be involved in the creative process, and then once the deal's fine, they just turn around and go, no, go away.
Yeah, that is incredibly rude and incredibly mean. And I think there is that story of George Lucas, when he watches The Force Awakens, he turns around and he says, but there's nothing new. And you can, like he has since said that on some level he kind of regrets selling the franchise to Disney. Even though Lucas and Disney have had a very, very lucrative relationship. We talk about, you know...
Yeah.
You talk about George Lucas, you know, doing Captain EO for Disney World or Star Tours, or it's not like they didn't have a great relationship before, but I don't think Lucas was anticipating that Disney might, well, you know, Disney-fy the franchise by...
I mean, we'll post Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I would,
franchise.
I would charitably call that naive of him.
Yeah,
because Disney's gonna Disney.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact of the matter is, like, we at least like to think of ourselves as like existing outside the toxic fandom, who were probably like considering George Lucas like a pariah, but like once they didn't like what Disney did, they probably held him in such high regard and considered the prequels redeemed by the shortcomings of these Disney movies.
Yeah, I mean, that is that's something weird that I find about the prequels, that for the better part of like when did Force Awakens come out? That was so 15. And Empire came out, not Empire, Revenge of the Sith came out in 2005, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a solid 10 years where people were like, the prequels are the worst thing to happen to cinema and to the Earth and to the universe as we know it, and to several different parallel universes on top of that. And after the sequel trilogy, a lot of the discourse I've seen is like, oh, well, the prequels actually weren't that bad. There was a lot of cool ideas that just didn't come together. It's interesting that it's like the prequels have undergone a reevaluation, but we watched all of them and they're still, I still don't believe that they're very good movies. You guys still don't believe that they're very good movies.
Yeah. Nope.
Yeah, or even pretty
good movies. Yeah, and I think even the worst of the sequel trilogy is still in a lot of ways better than what we get in the prequels.
I disagree with that, but like I will see that ninth movie again. I like the problems that people had with the prequels at the time, the problems that one could still have with them, I think are very much reflected in Rise of Skywalker. But again, I had only seen each one of these movies once in theater, and I'm somewhat excited.
Yeah, I will definitely say that I don't think anything in the sequels comes as close to being as bad as stuff in the prequels. That can, of course, change on a rewatch, but we'll see.
Yeah. And so, our next movie, if you're watching along, is going to be Star Wars Episode 7, the movie that you never knew you wanted, and yet you got somehow anyways, The Force Awakens, which I think it actually took me a while to actually watch The Force Awakens, now that I think about it. I think one of my roommates that I was living with at the time, like, I think he bought the DVD. He's like, here, you can just have the digital code. And I don't think it came out in December 2015, so I don't think I watched it until like the middle of 2016. But I do remember having fond memories and good impressions of it. I think it's been like a year or two since I've actually sat down and watched it. But what are your guys' initial kind of thoughts before we dive into it in the next episode?
I thought it was fun. I mean, and effective in the sense that it was kind of a retread. The only thing that I thought was like a retread in the laziest sense was Starkiller Base. The rest of it was like these new characters. I like these new characters. They're cool.
Yeah, I kind of walked away from it feeling like, wow, that borrowed a lot from A New Hope. But, you know, it left me at least interested to see what was coming next, because goddamn J.J. Abrams, he is the master of the mystery box. That box is more often than not filled with shit.
Yeah, I was going to say he often doesn't know what the mystery is, what is in the mystery box. And I will put the sequel trilogy like this. It is proof positive of why, to steal the phrase from the MCU, you need an endgame. You need to know where you're going. You need to know, you need to have at least some idea of how it's going to end. Because if you don't,
right,
well, the original trilogy didn't know where it was going to end and somehow stumbled into success after success after success despite itself. The sequel trilogy doesn't know where it's going to go and stumbles into success and then controversy and then bitter hatred, basically. And on that note, that was a downer ending. Did someone tell a joke? Really, nothing?
You're putting us both on the spot.
My mind came up with two Ewoks that walk into a bar. Okay, now what?
Anyways, you can reach out to us by email. The email address is sequeldadcompletely. That wasn't a funny joke. It was a non-joke, but it's still like, I don't know. You can reach us by email at sequelizeit@gmail.com. You can leave us a voice message on Anchor, which I keep forgetting to mention that you can leave us a voice message. To steal a phrase from Mission Log, if you'd like to leave us a voice message, we would love to hear your voice. I'm just stealing other podcast bits now. You can also find us on Twitter at SequelizeIt. You guys want to mention your personal socials?
Yeah, my Twitter is my name, with no and alive in between it, or surrounding it, excuse me.
That is not helpful at all.
No.
My Twitter is FFBacklash, simple enough.
Alrighty, and we will see you next time on Sequelize It. Oh boy, it's about to get real, folks.